The time is now 10:34 a.m. on March 25th, 2024, and I am convening this inaugural video conference and telephone conference meeting of the Ad Hoc General Counsel Search Committee of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association. This meeting is being conducted pursuant to the Texas Open Meetings Act and the Association's antitrust policy. All information disclosed or discussed is to be used only for carrying out the business of the association. Proper notice of the meeting was filed on March 15, 2024, and published in the Texas Register in accordance with the Texas Open Meetings Act. A copy of the notice should be attached to the summary of the official minutes of this meeting. A quorum is achieved as two of the three members of the committee have been confirmed to be present by video or audio conference. Also in attendance are General Counsel Jackie Rickson, Executive Director Bart Bowles, and Association employees Jarrett Terry, Topping Haggerty, and from the Texas Department of Insurance, Sean Martin.
Also, Ted, I want to add Brandy Nichols
from our office.
Our office is also attending.
All right, additional association employee Brandy Nichols. Apologize.
Thank
you. All right. I think that's it for the preliminaries. So, Bart, I know you produced an agenda. First, check
yes,
that.
And if I could take a minute to kind of explain big picture, the goal of that agenda is to try to take this in small, manageable pieces and kind of walk through the steps of how to develop this process, how to go through it. And so I'll try to keep us on track on the agenda, but it's just an outline. I wanted this to be very much an open architecture so the committee can have an opportunity to voice any thoughts they have on the process. And good morning, Ms. McCandless. Welcome to the meeting.
Yes, I apologize for being late. I had another call go over. Thanks.
That's just fine. So, Ted, you now have your full committee.
Excellent.
So, during this, I want to have one other thing, Sean, and if there were anyone else from TDI, I'd mention them as well. We are very interested. Anything we discuss about the process or as we get more into this about where to look for a counsel and potential candidate, individuals or firms, I can speak for the association, but not for the committee. And I guess it's me personally. We'd like to hear from you. If you have any thoughts about, please consider this and here's something else you may want to add to the mix. We want to make sure that TDI has voice in this process. And so anytime you want to chime in, feel free.
One question, Bart. I'm looking at that email you sent with the agenda, and I don't have access to that on through your portal. Is there another?
It's on the website.
Is it on the website? Okay.
Yep. If you want to look at the website, if not, we can email it to you real quick. But if you look on the
keep going. I'll find it. Thank you.
Okay.
And Bart, is it possible to put it on the screen here?
I'm going to do that right now. I was just making preliminaries, but
yeah.
Here we go. Can everyone see that?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Since this is the first meeting, there's no minutes to consider. And Ted, I'm ready when you are, if you'd like to talk about agenda item one.
Sure. And maybe in advance of that, I'm just going to kind of summarize from our preliminary discussion. I think it's something we've discussed as a whole board in contemplation of this process, but focusing on really three areas for this particular group to look toward, and there may be others, but at least initially wanted to take the opportunity with this change in regimes, as it were, to kind of zero base some of our structure and confirm as a board through this committee what we think might be best practice for the group going forward. And so not only are we going to discuss how to go about identifying and vetting possible candidates, but also I think a couple of things here initially. You know, first of all, we as an association are somewhat unique across the country in having both a general counsel and a board counsel. So at some point, I'd like us to discuss further our thoughts regarding both of those roles and whether we should continue in similar fashion, or if we those roles might be combined, or other alternatives that might be considered separately. I know quite a few folks that might have some qualification, not nearly the level of Jackie's qualification. I think we're not going to find someone of that caliber, but moving down tier two, tier three in the preference, there will be individuals and then there will be firms. And so I think one thing we can discuss, and it may end up being on a particular basis based on qualifications of one or the other, but as a general discussion, it would be good to know people's thoughts on a preference between an individual or a firm, or does it matter? Is it just the most qualified? And then finally, and I think what we're going to discuss first is the timeline for this process. I'd like to set up some deadlines for us to meet so that we stay on time and that Jackie can enjoy her retirement as planned and not be begged back because we failed in our duties here as this committee. So is that sound to your recollection, Bart?
Yes, and you will see as we work through the agenda, items two, three, and four kind of nail or lay out the steps that Chair Kennedy just described. On the timeline, we have it up front, but it may be something as we talk through the items, we have to revisit the timeline at the end. So it's going to be somewhat fluid the more we get into it and decide where we need to do additional work or schedule additional time.
So, Bart, with that, you have there in, on the agenda your proposed timeline that would keep us on track for transition. Do you want to walk us through that, or do folks have they already reviewed it, have questions, concerns?
Yes, and let me start with the charge. I mean, it may sound obvious that you want this committee to look for and provide a recommendation to the board of directors on selection of a new general counsel. But we wanted to make sure that we know this committee is going to be very instrumental in developing the process for where to look and what should be the requirements and qualifications for a potential candidate. What is the process to distribute and solicit applications and gather them, the time frames, then how to conduct interviews and the negotiations. And throughout that process, there'll be some reporting back to the board of directors, because ultimately it's going to be a board of directors decision. So the charge may sound simple, but there's a lot of steps in it. So thinking of those steps, this is not just me. Jackie and I both put our heads together. And our thought was, and I think I'm going to work backwards here. If we want to have a new general counsel in place and have somewhat of an orientation delivered, have that person comfortable providing those services at year end 2024 so Jackie can retire, it would seem appropriate that we try to get that person identified, selected, and on board by the October board of directors meeting. That may require some interim meetings, not only of this committee, but maybe one of the board to do that. That way they can sit in on a board meeting and then they've got a couple of months to transition toward the end of the year. Of course, Jackie has been very magnanimous to say she would be somewhat available into 2025, but we don't want to overstay our welcome with her time. So that would be the end result. And now we look where we are today. Today, we want to go through and talk a lot about the structure and the steps we need to go through and schedule that out. April through June is going to be the heart of this process to develop the request for interest, distribute it, how we gather applications and evaluate the requirements of the individual candidates, and then once we do all that in June, April through June and July, we'll start screening, doing background checks, interview, and possibly follow-up interviews with potential candidates. And at the end of July, there'll be a report to the board, but there may be an additional meeting in Yeah, it's August. It could also be pull into early September. And then September and October would be negotiations and engagement. So that's kind of the timeline. A lot of it's going to depend on between now and the end of June. Got a lot of work to do. Any questions on that overview?
No, I don't have a question, Bart. I guess just so I have some notes here, I guess, and we'll get into these in a moment. But before we get into the particulars of job description, job requirements, what we want to find in this individual, whether we want to continue the process of the general counsel participating beyond the association at the national level through NOLGA, and, as you do, Bart, and Jackie has historically participated at that level. I have great arguments for continuing to do that, but I think we should take this opportunity to zero base and make sure that that's where we want to go in our search and make that part of the job description. But before we get there, help me with the whole idea of general counsel versus board counsel. Do we do, right now just want to concentrate on general counsel and not discuss the board counsel, or should that be the beginning of this discussion, so we put that to rest first. What's your recommendation?
Well, that is actually the next item. That is the item for
That
first
was my
discussion into item
segue.
two.
That was my segue for you, Mark.
Perfect. So in item two, the first thing we provided here is a little background on the roles of board counsel and general counsel. And it's a little unique in this association has the board counsel and a general counsel, but that all stemmed from when the association was managed by a management company, Lashell, Kauffman & Bowles. And in 97, 98, when the association was managed under a turnkey contract with a management company, rather than through the direct employees as it had been since the privatization in 1992, there needed to be a board counsel to handle those negotiations with the management company on contract. And then also there were some equipment issues and things like that. So Lashell Kauffman and Bowles had its own counsel, and that counsel provided the general counsel functions to the association. So the association had its own board counsel. When that structure ended in 2003, and the association returned to being managed by employees, the board decided to continue the board counsel role and the general counsel role. Shelby Betts served as general counsel for 20, or excuse me, as board counsel for 25 years and retired at year end 2023. During that period, there was significant overlap. There were specific areas of governance that board counsel would advise the board, but there were times when I would seek counsel from both just to have two legal perspectives. But Jackie has always served as the general counsel, day-to-day activities, coverage issues, strategic direction on transactions, and representing the association in a host of forms from courts to NOLGA and other situations. After Jackie's retirement, we did have a brief discussion with the board, and I had an extensive discussion with the then chair, Jim Lewis. And it was agreed that the board counsel position could be all those duties performed by the general counsel. And when we talk in a moment, we're going to talk about the job description. And there is a line where the duties of the general counsel do end. And you might want to seek, or the board would want to seek outside counsel for certain activities. But first, let's talk again, as Chair Kennedy just mentioned. Are you comfortable with the combining of the roles of board counsel and general counsel?
Bart, can I say a couple of things
Yes.
just before we get into that? One thing I do want to specify is at the time in 1998, when Lashell Kauffman and Bowles became the management company that was separate from the board, I was general counsel basically to Lashelle Kaufman and Bowles for the purpose of doing guarantee association work. I was not general counsel to them on any kind of corporate basis, and they had other clients, and I wasn't involved with those other clients. And so I think that there's from time to time there has been a concern that, my involvement back at that time was representing the management company as an entity versus, and then we had the board on the other side as the client. And that was not the capacity in which I re represented Lashelle Kaufman and Bowles. My sole role was what you all kind of think of it, I think now is representing the guarantee association or the our statutory obligations aspect. And then the other thing I would say is, and a lot of this goes back a long time now, but in 1998, very few entities were thinking very much about corporate governance at all. And there were an assortment of reasons why that has changed over time. But NOLGA was pretty forward thinking about corporate governance. And so a lot of the things that we sort of consider our fundamental corporate governance documents were actually things that were first done on the NOLGA level and then came down, to the state guarantee association levels. And I was the person who was the primary drafter of most of those, governance documents. And in addition to, the work I've done for the Guarantee Association all these years, I have a lot of business clients and I have a lot of nonprofit clients. And so I've done a lot of this governance kind of work with them, which is relatively transferable kind of work, I would say, to the Guarantee Association. And so I think it's a good idea to really think about at this point, what are the legal needs of the association and how do they need to be met? And I think at this point, there's not a requirement to have the separate board counsel and general counsel, but some of that, might depend on what kind of qualifications applicants actually. Addition to what Bart was saying about, having the board having counsel for things like if there is going to be a contract with the executive director, then I think separate board counsel to do that makes sense for two reasons. One is because that would be a much more complicated kind of arrangement than a straightforward W-2 employee who gets the, basic employee benefits that somebody gets. And then two, I see that the sort of the management of the executive director as slightly different from the other responsibilities. But I think the day-to-day governance type things can certainly be handled by the general counsel. And one other thing I'll mention here too, and Ted alluded to the fact that, our association is different in a lot of ways from other associations. And Ted, I think you and Jim, since you serve on other boards, I mean, you'd have firsthand knowledge of this, but in my observation, I would say one of the things that is different about this association is that the executive director is so strong. And there are other associations where the executive director is not nearly as strong. And what ends up happening is that the general counsel does a lot of things that otherwise the executive director would do. And I'll just throw my hat into the ring and say, I think that you should continue with the strong executive director and the general counsel being an attorney, as opposed to, basically being the executive director and having a more of an administrator as your executive director instead of truly an executive position.
That's helpful, Jackie.
Can I ask you to clarify something, Bart? I'm sorry, didn't mean to.
Yes.
You had made the statement that your discussions began, and I may have misheard. You said on Jackie's retirement. Did you mean on Shelby's retirement, or was that?
Well, at the same time that Shelby was retiring, Jackie and I had started talking last year about her retirement.
Okay.
So both those were going on at the same time. We knew Shelby was retiring, and then Jackie and I had the discussion about when she might retire, and we started planning how to timeline this out.
Thank you.
Bart, are you wanting our initial kind of reactions, thoughts at this point on whether we need two or one?
Well, I think it would be helpful as we're moving forward if there's any concerns. And
No, I
Jackie
mean
did.
my feeling is we're never going to have another Jackie. She's amazing. And Shelby was awesome, and there was a historical reason for having two. In my mind, moving forward, we have one general counsel, and then we seek other external legal advice as needed on occasion or whenever. But it seems like we need a strong general counsel to support our strong executive level executive director, as just discussed. And it seems to me that's probably more consistent with other guarantee funds. I don't know if we had a page showing how the other statutory guarantee funds are structured in terms of their legal support, but Jackie's services have been invaluable. The other thing, again, I think we talked about at the last public meeting was that after she retires, if she has an interest, it would be helpful to have her on retainer or an hourly to be able to consult and provide expertise to the new general counsel, who, even if we get them set up by October, there's going to be a learning curve. My preference, obviously, is going to be hopefully we'll find somebody who also represents other guarantee funds potentially, or has experience in this area because it's so complex. And it would be helpful to have someone who's already familiar with the receivership process and things like that. So, and it's a very small pool of people, frankly. But anyway, that's just my thoughts on it.
Thanks, Patty. Jim, what do you think?
I think I agree with Patty. I don't think there's any reason to have separate kind of standing separate counsel positions. This is unique in my experience, at least with any of my boards. I think, I mean, maybe Jackie mentioned day to day the governance stuff. I would think the general counsel could handle. And agree with Patty and Bart. There may be situations where we want to hire separate counsel, but for specific issues. So I guess I would make some of the governance stuff part of the job description that we're after, and just plan on the general counsel being able to handle most of the day-to-day stuff. That's how, you know, that makes sense to me.
So, Bart, I think the committee is unanimous. I agreed 100% with comments just made, without even having heard their opinions. My proclivity, as I've expressed over the years, is that we transition to a single general counsel when the opportunity presents. Between direct participation and my team members who are also serving on boards, I think I have access to maybe 10 boards or so at this point, and this structure is unique. I appreciate the history behind its creation, but going forward, I think we're fine with a single general counsel, not a board counsel, and we can move toward fulfilling the general counsel with that in mind, adding any necessary components from Shelby's old role to this, or as Patty suggests, reserving those for ad hoc retainers on an hourly basis as needed. But frankly, I don't know that that would be that often. We can get into the particulars of job description for the general counsel with respect to governance and legal perspective research and the like, in a moment. But I think we're in agreement that going forward, we're looking for a single role and we will not have a board counsel.
Thank you. So what we have, and before I put it on screen, on pages 2-2 and 2-3 of your materials is a combination of what you've seen in the past, where we used to have the role of board counsel and the role of general counsel. We have now one presentation of the duties of general counsel. And then on pages 2-4 and 2-5 is a new document you've not seen. that Jackie assembled. And I think it's very good because it takes these duties and it groups them into categories of activities that is very helpful to see. But I thought it might be helpful for the committee for Jackie to touch on some of the high points of these. And then Jackie, could you mention in going through some of these, you tell me which one of the documents you want to put up. But when you go through it, where there might be a line where you think the general counsel duties may stop and it would be advantageous to seek outside counsel on specific issues.
Okay, so I actually think that the one starting on 2-4 is a little easier to work with, Bart.
Ready to. Here we go.
So I put this together in January, and basically it was looking at the two separate job descriptions, as Bart said, and then sort of organizing it by topic, which, as you all know, is always hard to do because certain things don't really fit in the right place and you have some overlap and whatever. But so I started with the general responsibilities, which would be to represent the entity, including the board and staff, in the course of carrying out guarantee association functions, represent the association in receiverships that are domiciled in Texas and then in other states, and then advise the executive director and board on corporate matters. So those are sort of the really big general categories. Then the receivership responsibilities are the things, that I spend a lot of time on, and I would anticipate any general counsel would. So this is interpreting the statute, coverage and claims determinations, reinsurance, TPA matters, negotiating contracts. And the primary ones are TPA related, assumption reinsurance, and then a host of other agreements just to, get things done. Which we have lots of examples of those in Friday, health insurance company. Handle disputed claims. And, our approach to disputed claims for a very, very long time now has been to really not go to the mat on these things, but, resolve them because rarely is a claim that we are going to encounter, going to be worth, a lot of litigation, and then manage claims litigation. And we haven't had a lot of that again
Right.
lately either. That is just for the Texas Association. The big litigation we were involved with was the Lincoln Memorial, where we had you all know, a very large component of people involved in that one.
So, Jackie, I'm going to add to this as you as you speak, and I'd like to touch on that claims management and litigation management. I think it's been important there that Jackie and I work hand in hand on this, and I use her expertise to evaluate, how far do we push on these claims? We don't roll over. We do not stray from the provisions of the statute, provisions of the policy, but there are areas that are somewhat gray, and it's just not very clear. So where there are areas of dispute and interpretation, we do diligently work to resolve those, but we don't roll over. But we do also want to avoid a bad precedent. So there's a lot that goes into play here, and it looks simple with six words on the page, but it's really not, and it
That's
takes a
true.
lot of effort.
And I will say here that, a lot of times when a company goes insolvent, if there's litigation, a lot of it is pretty pathetic litigation. And, where the company is either outright denying claims that they shouldn't be denying, or they are taking a really, really hardball, defense posture. Which might make sense for a solvent company for any number of reasons, but it doesn't generally make sense for us. And when I'm thinking about claims disputes, I'm not thinking about an issue that is basically rooted in our statute. It's rooted in the insurance policy itself, and it's an issue over the claim. So I have a different opinion on how we would approach, a statutory interpretation matter. And even those we managed to, like assessment appeals, we've managed to work through those. And then another major thing is representing the guarantee association's interest as a creditor. And the primary thing here is, there are lots of pleadings that are filed in these receiverships, and we file either waivers or objections to them. This is if they're pending in Texas. And so there is a lot of work that I do that involves tracking these applications, making sure they make sense, and being in contact with the SDR about questions and that sort of things. And that is very much, I would characterize, a being there kind of role, because the SDRs know that we are paying attention to what's going on in the receiverships. And as an extension of that, representing our position as a creditor. Then for assessments, interpret statutory provisions and then handle assessment disputes and protests. We've had a couple of protests over the years that looked like they were really going to develop into something that was going to require a hearing. And then fortunately, once you get into the logistics of who is going to hear it, because it's an administrative proceeding, then it becomes much more beneficial to settle, because there's lots of uncertainty in that litigation chain of assessments. Then legislation responsibilities. This is something, that I have typically done. I could see this being something that maybe would be different depending on who your next counsel was, but monitoring changes to the NAIC Life and Health Guarantee Association Model Act. And at least once, maybe more than that, I have been on NOLGA committees that were involved in really working on these NAIC Model Guarantee Association Acts, and then drafting the amendments that the board believes they would like to see in our bill. For mostly Talhi and ACLI to then actually carry through the legislative process and then to work as a resource as needed on those. Turning to corporate governance, the main things are attending board and committee meetings, then working with Bart and his staff on agendas, meeting minutes, meeting materials, providing advice on open meetings and open records, and we are, I think, one of two or three states that are open meeting guarantee associations. So that's, a wrinkle that's different. Drafting revisions to these various corporate governance documents and providing advice to the association and the board regarding board duties and fiduciary obligations. Assist the board in complying with statutory and common law fiduciary duties. Assist the board with the annual self-evaluation or equivalent, and then attend new board member orientation and any other board training. And one thing I'll say here, just on the, oh, actually, it's on the next slide. Never mind.
Here we go.
Yes. Okay. So provide advice regarding insurance for the association and the board. Interpret the association statute with respect and re regulations with respect to how they apply. Provide advice regarding general employment and personnel matters and assist on the employee handbook and employment policies. And this is an area where I've hired outside employment counsel a few different times. For various matters. And I think tricky employment questions are an area where hiring specialized counsel is a good idea. And that's not because there's so much a potential conflict with the board of directors, but that's an area of the law where you can make mistakes quickly that can cause you a lot of problems.
And
Then I've
Jackie, you might
also
mention under the open meetings, there have been occasion where we've had to get outside counsel expertise, like an open records request. Sometimes those require a little bit more expertise, but you guide and lead that outside counsel. So it doesn't mean you're hands off. You're still working with them.
That is true. That's true. And then I've also provided, the association advice on office leases and IP matters and an assortment of other things. And a lot of this just depends on what it is and what level of complexity. So there are certain IP matters that I would, were they to come up, I would say, we've got to hire somebody who's got more expertise in this area. If we're looking at sort of a standard service agreement for someone to provide whatever IP related, IT related service, then that I think that falls into that responsibility. And then provide advice regarding board policies and procedures, attend meetings and interact with TDI on and other organizations on matters of interest to the Guarantee Association. Meet regularly with the executive director. And then manage litigation involving the Guarantee Association and locate and screen outside counsel as and when needed. And then respond to requests or other financial review requests when needed. And then this last category is responsibility specifically involving the board. And the first bullet I put there was assist with the evaluation of the executive director as requested. So for a long, long time, the board chair or the personnel committee chair would really take the laboring oar in conducting the executive director's evaluation. And the way it was is I would, at the request of the board, I would send out the evaluation and then it would go back to the chair of the personnel committee, and the chair of the personnel committee would, assemble it and then send it to the committee for review and what have you. And this is an area where, in some ways, depending on the board members and how much time they have, how much access to staff they have to help them do Guarantee Association things, can really make a difference. Because we had several personnel committee chairs who did a fabulous job with handling the executive director's evaluation. And then we had one personnel committee chair who really did not. And that created a lot of problems and led to the evaluation of the executive director being mostly conducted by board counsel. And I tell you all of that to say that I think, there are ways to handle the evaluation of the executive director without it being managed by the general counsel, handled by the personnel committee, and then just deciding how the general counsel can be of assistance or how, other members of the committee can be of assistance to carry out that, because that's a, a very important function of the board, as you all know. Then the next thing would be assist with identification and resolution of conflicts of interest. And this would include, I think, if there is a conflict of interest, which means that the board or a board member is at odds with the association as a whole. And I think at that point, the job of the general counsel would be to flag that and then say, hey, I think we need to get special counsel for the board, depending on what it is, or if it involves only a board member, then work with at least the chair of the board on what are some options then to handle that.
And we have had a couple of instances where a member of the board of directors initially had an interest in a transaction involving the association. And Jackie's been good to advise them of their obligations and their fiduciary duties. And we've been able to avoid those instances. Most often, the board member will recuse themselves and actually withdraw from the transaction. We've also had a couple instances where the troubled company coming that was. We alert or have been alerted and would be coming to the board actually involved a board member. And we've had the board member to not only recuse himself from the discussion, but not be actually in the room to hear anything about that company. There are some times when counsel is very necessary to walk a very tight line and handle some delicate situations, because a transaction or a company that touches a director could come before the board.
That's true. So the next bullet I put on there was to provide advice to board or individual board members related to board service. And this would be, and I've actually, as even in my role as general counsel, from time to time, board members will say, will ask me a question about, do I need to do this or should I do that? And so this is really related to their board service. And this would be a place where if a question, comes from a board member that indicates a potential conflict of interest or one of these situations that Bart just described, then it might require, some other work besides, or some other steps besides just answering a question about board service. And then the last bullet I put there was coordinate as may be needed with board separate retained counsel regarding employment arrangements or contracts with the executive director. And really, I would say on if the board were to retain counsel for really any purpose. And then I would also say that, if your general counsel can't recognize a conflict of interest and provide competent advice about what to do with it, then you need to fire the general counsel because that's the main part of their job, in my view.
So, Ted, the intent in giving you this list in one place, and I'm glad it's categorized and grouped like this, to have Jackie go through it, is I don't know if the committee members have ever heard the full breadth of responsibilities and the duties that the general counsel provides. Of course, this is probably a bit much to throw out there in front of someone as an RFI, but you will need this in your mind when you're evaluating candidates of every it's every aspect: insurance law, common law, transactional law, receivership experience, guarantee association specific, knowledge. It covers a lot of ground, and it just will help you. I thought it would help you to have this big picture as we move forward in this process. So if you have questions of Jackie on anything she's just described.
Yeah. So Bart, I'll jump in, kind of chair's prerogative, and start the discussion. You took the words out of my mouth. I mean, Jackie, first of all, thank you for putting this together. Bart, thanks for asking her to do so. This is very helpful. But more important, or of equal import, I think we all value and appreciate your role and your participation over the years, but until you see it on paper, you don't appreciate the breadth or the depth. And so thank you for your years of service. I hadn't, not seeing it all on paper. We know you're doing a great job, but we don't know the level of activity you've been involved in. And so thank you for your years of service. This is a lot that you've done for us.
Wow.
I have two questions, and then I'm interested in what other committee members may have to say. So, first of all, I think this is a pretty comprehensive list, great for us to use. We can tweak it if necessary, but I'm pretty happy with this. There are two things, one that you called out and one that I called out earlier, that I would ask the committee to have some discussion with respect to line item responsibilities. One of those is you mentioned the legislative tracking, drafting aspect, and whether that would be something that we would want the new general counsel to continue to do. And the other that I had mentioned is, as a general counsel representing the association, you, the general counsel, are no doubt tied into the NOLGA activity with respect to national insolvencies, insolvencies of foreign entities that have business in Texas. But it's my belief, it's my understanding that both you and Bart have taken on leadership roles at NOLGA and participated beyond just the interests and representations of the Texas Association, but on the behalf of NOLGA and the guarantee associations around the country, offered your expertise and leadership in guiding these insolvencies. And so from my perspective, I think both of those items are things that we should intentionally address and include or exclude in the job description going forward. I'll offer that I think both should remain part and be delineated in the job description of the general counsel. I think the Texas Association, first of all, I feel strongly that the tracking and drafting aspect is something that should be part and parcel to the general counsel's role. I find it to be the case with most general counsels and other guarantee associations. But then secondarily, with respect to this volunteering for additional leadership and service at the NOLGA level, I think we've seen the value at the association level of both Bart and Jackie's involvement at the national level, and it pays dividends beyond compare. And I would suggest that we would want to find someone that would be willing to continue in similar fashion, including the travel involved, including the participation beyond just the association's interest. But I'm interested in other folks' thoughts on that. And then I'll just offer up my third final comment. Jackie, I believe, well, let me just ask. So of your topics, the last topic seems to cover some of what might be the board counsel's job as well.
Right.
Are there other things that we would need to add to this list that were part of Shelby's board counsel job that aren't listed here?
You know, the only thing I probably didn't list there, although I think it's sort of implicit in there, would be to, actually it was in mine too, but assist with board training and committee training. So kind of that board training element. But I don't think there's anything else.
You know, Jackie, there's one thing where you put on here, provide advice to the board. The one thing we've always stressed, and I think it should be on there, is to be directly accessible to the board.
Yes.
So if the board wants to contact general counsel with questions, they don't need to go through me. Right. I don't filter that at all. The counsel is always directly accessible by all directors at any time.
So those are both good ideas that maybe, Jackie, we could ask you to add to this last section of your list.
Sure. Yep.
But for the other committee members and TDI, any thoughts with respect to this list? Any thoughts with respect to the two points I raised, whether we should include those as a job description going forward or not?
I think this, Patty, one, it's a huge job. I think the NOLGA participation is important, and you have to go to the meetings. I think the issue in terms of leadership at NOLGA is going to be depending on who we hire. If we have someone younger who's going to learn, they're not going to have the expertise. They're not going to get invited like Jackie right away to be at some higher level consulting or, on these committees. So, I mean, I think it's important that would be helpful, but I think that's going to depend on the candidate. The other thing I worry a little bit, Ted, is if we hire someone who's a solo practitioner, that what I'd be interested in knowing from Jackie, I mean, to me, this is almost a full-time job. So how did you manage other clients? And if there may be other lawyers that have a great expertise, but might not have the availability that Jackie has had to be able to do a massive amount of work and support for the Guarantee Association. So I think some of these things, may have like the critical functions versus like, it could be that we get someone who Jackie was so involved in all that litigation and traveling with Bart and all that. And it could be that sometimes some of these things may have to be outsourced or not done depending on who we get and their availability. I mean, I look at this list, which is amazing, and I so appreciate you putting this together for us because it gives us a better picture. But this is a lot of time. I mean, I think that's going to make it – that's what we're going to have to weigh when we evaluate potential
Let me
General
respond
Counsel.
to the time part of your comments there, Patty. So these don't all occur at the same time. You know, I
Okay.
mean, so those are things that are part of the general counsel job, but they don't
Right.
all occur at the same time.
Right, like the legislative is cyclical. Some
Yes,
of this stuff is not
yes.
always. But I would, but it'd be interesting. I mean, do you feel like someone, I mean, this is still, we'd want to be a priority client. We wouldn't want
Oh
to be
yeah,
one of those
no, I agree. I
one of,
agree. And
I've
I
got 40 clients and I'm going to get to you when I can versus you
sure.
always, it always feels like we've got 100% of your time. I know we don't, but in terms of your responsiveness and support of the Guarantee Association. So, I mean, I just think knowing, working with lots of law firms and lots of lawyers over the years, I just something we're going to have to think about, Ted, in terms of like
Yeah.
when we add things, it's like in a perfect scenario, but I think it'll be able, we may have to refine this list once we pick somebody, depending on how
Right.
much time they have and what they're going to do for us versus what may have to be outsourced on an ad hoc basis.
Yeah. And Patty, maybe a way to do that is to take this list and go down it and identify, easy nomenclature, the need to do versus the nice to do. The
Yes.
tier one considerations and the tier two considerations, however you want to reference them. But these are the must-haves, and these are things that Jackie's doing today that we'd love to have, but we'll see based on the applicants whether they're capable and willing and have the time available. Jackie, I don't know if this is a fair question of you, so tell me if it isn't. But doing everything that we've described, that as you have been, if you were to put in how many hours a week, I know it's a peak and trough type endeavor. You're focused 100% of your time on weeks, and then maybe there's weeks where you don't do any association work. But if you were to blend that across the year, what's your average number of hours per week spent with just the association?
So you would think I would know the answer to that question, Ted, and I don't. But this is what I can tell you. I can tell you, like for this past year, which is an anomaly for sure because of the Friday and then the bright stuff, and the fact that, you know, I am not doing, I made the decision, I think starting in 2022, maybe, that I wasn't going to take any new other clients. But I would say, you know, this past year, Guarantee Association took up 90% of my working time. And of that, I would say 80% of that was Friday. So
Jackie, I can actually answer that for you.
that.
I
Well, let me say a couple more things, Jarrett.
sure.
But I can tell you what I, you know, what I always did was I kind of looked at on a percentage basis over a year how much time was spent on the Guarantee Association. And so there were a couple of years when we had a whole bunch of Lincoln Memorial stuff, when there was, you know, we had phone calls every day and just so much stuff, where I was probably spending 75% of my time on Guarantee Association things. And then other years I would spend about 30% of my time on Guarantee Association. So, and part of it depends on whether we have domestic receiverships, or most of our receivership work is not Texas domestics, because, you know, when it's a Texas domestic, there's just a lot more things to do than when it's not. Okay, go ahead, Jarrett.
First of all, are you okay with me sharing the amount of hours that you worked?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. So
Just
roughly,
hours, don't do dollars.
no, I'm not doing
Dollars.
dollars.
Okay.
Roughly 900 hours last year is what Jackie put in. And that's about 17 hours a week, billed hours. And last year was an anomaly. I'd have to go back and look at prior years, but it was significantly higher last year.
Well, and we know that those hours ratcheted up in April, because at the end of March we picked up Friday. So in April and May, we started doing a lot more work, and the rest of the year was really busy. So I can say this, Ted, there are times when, and Jackie did mention, if there's a multi-state insolvency and a lot of the work is done by the task force and counsel to the task force, There's not as much legwork for us to do. There's still some legal work, but it's review. And it's take analysis from the task force and put it in perspective of the Texas statute and Texas law. But if it's a Texas domestic insolvency, it's a lot more work in front of the special master with the SDRs and frontline legwork to just go through and, we got to cut the weeds. So we're going through a lot more detail on those. So it is cyclical, not just volume of work, but the nature and the type of the insolvency we're working on.
Yeah, that leads me to another question, but I want Jim to have an opportunity. Jim, did you have, I saw you try to pop in a moment ago.
Yeah, well, some of it's already been covered, Ted. I guess just going back to your three items, the kind of legislative tracking, I think obviously following any changes to the model, and then kind of drafting any changes that filter down to the Texas GA statutes. I think that obviously to me be integral to the general counsel job. I think that's important. NOLGA participation. Agree with Patty on the leadership. It depends on who we hire, whether they can have leadership, but at the very least, I think active participation in NOLGA would be a must. I don't know how you could do the job, frankly, without being very involved with all the NOLGA activities to know what's going on, who's talking about what. I don't know. I don't think you could be effective without that piece. So I would think attendance at the the meetings, NPCs in person or online, just I think you'd have to be involved to do the job well, I would think. And then my concerns about the governance piece, I think most of the things that I thought about, the qualifications are listed either at the bottom of, I guess it's 2.4 or 2.5, captured most of the items that I was thinking about with the kind of board, very broad board council. I think the 2.4 had the governance piece, and I kind of combined those, and there was a lot of that stuff listed there too. So I think, I don't know, between those two sections, most of those things have been covered. I was going to ask about the percentages because I think it's you're going to have to look for NOLGA background, GA background, have anybody that could do these things. And if you don't have that type of deep background, I'm sure it would take a lot longer than it took Jackie to do some of these things. So we'd have to keep that in mind too. I'm sure she's a lot more efficient
That's a good point.
than many of the other pieces, people, we could find to try to approach these type of items.
Yeah, really good point. Sean, from TDI's perspective, how do you reflect on this list and any thoughts?
I think a good, I was trying to think of the best word, the best description, the fullest description, the better. Particularly, the fullest description of particular board duties that would be required, is a great idea so that a decision could be made if outside counsel was appropriate. So I think your Jackie's thoughts of adding the more the better that can be added to that from her experience and what would be on there for board duties, I think is a great idea.
So, Ted, if I heard this correctly, to make sure I've captured some of the comments, and Jackie, you probably did too. There's a couple of things on NOLGA. There's a couple of things on board support. I won't go into them here. A little bit more maybe on legislative, and I've made some notes. But I think the first important thing I saw is within these categories to kind of prioritize vital or more important aspects and then the lesser duties under each one. So maybe make some delineation under these categories, and we can do that in refining this structure. Or Jackie can, and I can argue with her, which we
Yeah,
forgot to
I think
say that
that
arguing with the executive director is a very important role for general counsel. We
I
do
think
that a
that would be
lot.
very helpful. So it'll
Sure.
clearly, and I would look at it from this frame of mind. So, whether it's tier one, tier two, as Patty rightly pointed out, we may not find someone with the qualifications to serve in a leadership role at the national level. They'll have to earn those stripes. So I would say, you know, these are characteristics that on day one we would want the general counsel to be able to undertake. These are other characteristics that over time we would hope that they would develop or be able to consider. So I would leave them as part of the job description, but as a nice to do over time, not a need to do day one. I don't want an applicant to think that if it's a tier two or tier three consideration that we don't care about it. It's just that maybe we appreciate we're not going to find someone that can handle all of these on day one. So I think that's right. I think if we could add, you know, on the board side, the board training or what have you, and highlight a few more of these things, as Sean pointed out, the more detailed, the better. And then Jackie, if you could take a stab at somehow delineating or differentiating must-haves versus nice-haves, whether that's just, you know, an asterisk next to the ones that are tier two or tier three versus the priorities. But your advice on that would be helpful. I don't want to put cart before the horse, but I just think it's worth mentioning at this point, as we come to agreement on job description and job requirements. I think part of the discussion going forward will include whether we want to hire someone on an hourly basis or a retainer basis. And frankly, looking at this list, I was going to add to that whether we should consider hiring someone full time as general counsel for the association if they're spending this much time. If it's 20 hours a week, then that's one consideration, but it looks a lot more than that to me. And sounds like Patty, you were thinking the same things. I personally believe that a retainer is probably the sweet spot between hourly and full time. I do know that in other boards we pay hourly for a general counsel, but I also know that they're not as involved as Jackie has been. So offer that up for discussion. But with respect to this particular agenda item, I think we have a great start. And if we could ask Bart, you and Jackie to go back and make these additions that we've just discussed, that'd be helpful.
So Ted, if we could, under that item we're talking about right now, the last item 3C we have on the agenda is three possible structures of how to engage a general counsel. And one, we said, should that person be an employee of the association? Two, should we be looking at a solo practitioner? And three, are we looking for a firm to hire someone with a firm? And we thought we should take a moment, talk about the pros and cons of each to see if there's any one of these you want to take off the list before we get into the process of where do we look for candidates and how do we distribute it. So, do we want any focus on this? And I asked the committee of the three options, what are your thoughts?
This is our Ted, do you want to go first?
Oh, go ahead, Patty.
I mean, if we were looking for an employee, that's going to be a totally different job search than looking for an external firm, either solo or a firm, to act as general counsel. So, because of the ebb and flow of the business, it just didn't seem like, unless we decide we should hire somebody full time, like if we had the perfect person who's maybe a younger lawyer that would be there all the time. I don't know, Ted. It just seems to me those are two different, really extremely different types of searches, an employee versus a external counsel. And then from my perspective, I think we, would do either an RFP or just a, hey, we're looking for an external law firm, and we will probably get solo practitioners, a few, but for the most part, I would imagine we will get individual lawyers associated with firms that can handle the work. And part of the interview process, I think, would be whether you would be willing to make us, our priority client based on your retainer, anticipating that this is a pretty busy and demanding role. So I think that's, so to me, once we start filtering this out, we're not going to be able to get, someone who's a big partner with a ton of clients. They're just not going to have the resources. And my preference would be a specific individual, whether they're a solo practitioner or at a firm, because we want that one person we go to that becomes an expert. This is too complex for it to be outsourced out to to be the firm to be the general counsel, and then they give stuff to this associate or that associate. It needs to be someone who is, in my opinion, is super proud to have us as a client, would be long time dedicated to us like a Jackie, because it's too complicated. You can't just come zoom in and zoom out of it. You need to be someone who develops an expertise and stays committed to it. So to me, we're going to end up probably with people who are already representing other guarantee funds and that would be willing to have the time commitment. And then once we pick that person, we'll be able to know who, this person's not going to have the bandwidth to go if there's some other huge litigation we outsource or we outsource certain particular things. It just, anyway, my thought is probably we stick with this as being an outside lawyer and take applicants and evaluate them and make a decision whether they're a solo practitioner or at a smaller practice or at a big firm. But I would caution against hiring a firm as a general counsel because you could end up spending a ton of money and not having as good a expert on it. But that's just, anyway, I don't know what you think, Ted. But like even in my old firm, I've been in a big firm, we acted as general counsel, but it was a particular person at that firm that served a general counsel function for different trade associations. So we had to, anyway. Okay, I'll stop my
So
spiel.
I agree with you. I guess I have two opinions and then one question that you raised, Patty, that I had on my list to discuss. So with respect to type of hire, I agree. I don't think that we need to hire someone as a full-time employee. Jarrett, your comment was helpful in that regard. Notwithstanding this exhaustive list, if it's a 20-hour work week on average, then I don't know that we need to hire someone full-time for the job. I do feel that strongly that we should make this a retainer position and not an hourly. I encountered problems in other states where we're on an hourly basis, and I think too often you're penny wise and pound foolish if you're worried about billing hours and not asking questions that you should be asking. So a retainer mitigates that possibility. So my personal view is look for outside counsel on an annual retainer basis, in terms of type of retention. In terms of firm versus individual, I agree with you, Patty. Whether that individual is a sole practitioner or under the umbrella of a firm, ultimately you're looking at individuals. And I think we're not going to know those individuals, whether they're within a firm or on their own, until we begin receiving applicants. So we remain open to all applicants and we choose the individual that's best for our purposes, whether they're a sole practitioner or under a firm. The question you raised for me is, I appreciate, and at least one board I serve on uses general counsel that is general counsel that the firm advises several different guarantee associations across the country. And I've found that concerning and helpful over the years. The concerning piece of that is to the extent that we're all individual associations and in many instances have different views and perspectives on insolvencies, and we vote unilaterally in the best interest of our policyholders in our given state. If your general counsel is advising more than one guarantee association, do you compromise that in some fashion or another? On the other hand, you gain insight by leveraging the expertise that will be had from a firm involving themselves in multiple different associations. Jackie, I see you've come on screen, so it sounds like you may have an opinion on that.
Well, yeah, I do actually, and I agree with what you're saying pretty much there, Ted. I mean, one of the concerns that I have is, or Texas is a big state. It's a big insurance state, and this Guarantee Association has been a leader among guarantee associations, and I would like to, see that continue. And I think having a general counsel who is only general counsel to Texas, I think that fosters that. I also think that the Guaranty Association community is fairly collegial, and so the ability to call someone, call another general counsel or another counsel who you know works in this space to ask them, what do you think about this, or what's your state thinking about such and such, is an easy thing to do. So I think you can get some of the advantages of having someone who represents more than one state. I think you can get some of that through a different channel. One other thing I think is worth keeping in mind is whether it's important to have your general counsel be licensed in Texas. And there are always questions that come up about licensing and being licensed in one state and then representing an entity in another state. And I know in some states the way this is sort of set up to, I guess, get the benefit of both worlds is the Guaranty Association has a local attorney who is their, I mean, I don't even know what they call them, but is their local attorney, and then they use a firm that does more work on a national basis for guarantee associations for certain things as well.
That's helpful. Jim, Sean, what are your thoughts on this?
Ted, I think it's really already been covered for me. I agree on the focus on the external rather than an employee. Employee doesn't really make sense to me, I think, given the circumstances. Also agree that the focus ought to be on the individual, the practitioner, whether they're solo or a firm, is probably less important to me. Than having somebody that we know will be available to us, and that the GA will be a focus for them. I agree. I wouldn't want to hire a just generically a firm. That doesn't make sense to me. Retainer, I think that makes sense, Ted. I hadn't given that a lot of thought. But my other GAs where we have counsel, it's hourly, and I think a retainer does make sense, just based on my experiences there. Lastly, I guess to the last piece, I think it would be good if they had a Texas focus. That might be hard to do. It limits who we're looking for, I think, to some degree, because I don't think there are a lot of people nationally that can handle this stuff. But I think if there is a Texas focus there, that's very helpful. I think we would miss that if we didn't have it. So whether we can find that person, I don't know. But
Jackie
Hey,
Barr,
Ted. Oh, go
go ahead,
ahead.
Patty.
I think I would say on the licensure and the focus, I would definitely prefer someone licensed here. I guess when I thought about representing, there's other types of guarantee fund associations in Texas. So it's helpful if we have someone with, even if they're coming from some other, title or PNC or some other, that might be helpful. But to me, they would need to be licensed here. Otherwise, we're going to run into all those problems where they have to figure out whether it's something they can do or not, too. Plus, the legislative stuff, everything is so unique
Right.
in our
Right.
state anyway. I would hopefully, and I think we're going to end up with a decent pool of candidates. I'm maybe overly optimistic, but hopefully, I worry more about having someone who's going to be able to have the time, both the expertise and the time that they are going to be able to commit to this. Because it's just, again, I don't want someone to just add it on and then not be available, as Bart needs them and Jared and everybody else. We want someone who's going to be committed to it.
Right. Totally agree. And Bart, Jackie, well, maybe for the entire group, but by no means is this my area of expertise. While I think it would be helpful, and in comparison to other associations, I find helpful operating with a retainer versus an hourly billing system. Jackie, Bart, do you think we're going to lose some applicants if we identify in an RFI that we're looking for a retainer versus an hourly billing?
I have no idea, Ted. I have not thought about that at all. I think my impression would be, if the way that the board wants to go is retainer, then it be published that way. And then I think if somebody really is interested in this, but they don't like the idea of a retainer, they will pursue it anyway and try and change the arrangement.
Could we do like retainer preferred? And I've seen some creative arrangements too, where when we were with the when we did the Health Plan Association stuff, it was a monthly retainer. But if there was a special project or something that was outside the scope or particularly complicated, we would do separate hourly. But this is why your document is so excellent, Jackie, in terms of the scope of responsibilities. But I mean, it'd be great, Ted, if we could find someone who'd be willing to do it. To me, maybe the RFP is silent when we interview people. We say that's something we prefer, and give us, tell us what you think that would be, and how many hours. Maybe they still track their hours. And I had another arrangement. We had a regulatory counsel for a trade association that she tracked her hours. She had a monthly retainer, and in the event there was some like crazy period of time, like a Friday, once it exceeded that hour, she flipped to an hourly basis for the excess time.
I like that, Patty. I like being a little flexible, not necessarily reducing our applicant pool by saying something in the outset, but making, it's preferred, or we get into it in the interview process. I'm thinking not only in terms of individual's perspective with respect to the two different types of pay, but also thinking if you're working, and tell me if this is the case, Patty, because I don't know, but I would envision that in some instances, a qualified applicant may be working with the firm and they have to charge hourly. There is no one-offs for retainers, and we would lose them as an applicant if we tell them we're only taking retainers. Is that true or no?
Yeah, let me throw in. I think you're going to, because I can tell you when we were working as LCB, we had a few clients that we were flat retainer, and it was a flat fee, an annual fee. And on some of those, we had projects come in where we felt like, okay, we're now doing pro bono work for that client. So there needs to be some type of floor. And then a measurement point that they could be compensated for extraordinary hours. So if you structure it that way, I think you're going to keep your client or your candidate pool intact. It's up to you what's going to be necessary to disclose in your request.
So maybe for now, I like that idea, Bart, but if everyone is agreement, then maybe we leave this as a topic of discussion during the interview process, what type of retention will be had, hourly versus retainer. There are pros and cons to each. I like my view is I like the idea of a floor retainer with the understanding that extraordinary hours in a given week or month would allow for additional compensation at an hourly rate of X. I think that's fair. I know over in the Talhi side and other trade associations, J. Thompson and counsel and lobbying firms in Texas, we use exclusively flat retainer arrangements. So hopefully in Texas that's not foreign, but this is a little different animal to deal with. I like the idea of a I wouldn't characterize it as base plus additional, but here's your pay, but there's flexibility should extenuating circumstances force us to discuss additional compensation. But I think by leaving that negotiable, then you cast a wider net in terms of applicants, and then we, at the end of the day, I think my view, Patty, back to your point, we're just crossing our fingers that there's someone out there that's going to be able to undertake this, and I'm concerned that there isn't. And so I don't want to deter any qualified applicant on the onset. I would rather find the right person and then let's find a way to make it work with them than stipulate particularly everything involved, including compensation, and hope we find that one needle in the haystack.
Okay, with those thoughts, we ready to move ahead to another item? Not hearing you, Ted. You still there?
I'm here. Yes, I'm sorry.
Okay. So the next item, Ted, talks about actual the process and how do we distribute it? How do we publicize this? Let me say this. It's already publicized a little bit. I'm getting emails. People say, let me throw some names at you. And a lot of them is, here's something someone you might be interested with, and they're with this firm, and that firm has a lot of depth and things like that. And my response has been, I will let you know when the distribution of the information about this process is public, and everyone's going to be open, and the disclosure is going to be made public through all kinds of channels. There's none of this one-on-one. I don't want to think anyone's hardwired here. So we mentioned a few of the channels for noticing it here, and I'll just read them off, Ted. Of course, through the Texas Association of Life Health Insurers, through NOLGA. NOLGA has a document called The Wire that goes out. It's very broadly distributed in the industry, not only with guarantee associations, but also in our vendor list and to regulators. And then IAIR, the International Association of Insurance Receivers. This involves regulators, guarantee associations, property and casualty guarantee funds as well, and regulators. So it's really the receivership community. And then the Austin Bar. Jackie, any comments on the distribution through the bar?
Well, so if anyone who's a member of the Austin Bar Association would be on their email list and get the magazine. I don't really know. So I'm no longer a member of the Austin Bar Association, so I don't know what they submit anymore. But I sort of recall that you can either have a sort of an informal listing, or it might be one of these things where you pay to have space to have your job in there or your opening in there. So I would have to pursue that a bit. And
Jackie,
then
on that.
communications, Sean, I'd ask you, does the TDI have a way to distribute information about this posting?
I'd have to get with our communication staff, Bart, and I certainly can. We can't. I'd have to look to see what, how we would do that. We do have, certainly have a media, have an online presence. I'd have to see what was appropriate. I was
Okay,
going to
Sean.
suggest, as with Jackie, I'm not much of a joiner, so I've never been in the ABA, the Austin Bar Association. But you may want to consider the Texas Bar Journal
Okay. Yes.
as
Yeah,
a
that.
broader reach, within Texas.
I'm going to send you Bart a link. I was just looking on the Texas Bar Association website. You can post a job on the Texas Bar Association.
Okay.
Yeah, I get a weekly email from the Texas
Oh, that's
Bar
right. Yeah.
of jobs available. So that was going to
Okay.
be my comment is maybe I don't belong to the Austin Bar. I don't belong to the Houston Bar. I do belong to the Texas Bar.
Okay,
And
got it.
Yeah, I think it's free. I'm sending it to you, Bart.
Thank you. And Sean, I'll just mention as far as TDI, we're going to go into this next category. I was a little concerned putting this on there about a communication vehicle that TDI had that might be construed as this being a state position, which it
Well,
would not be. It may, in this outreach to professional colleagues, I kind of put TDI in that category. If TDI has someone that they think should be in the distribution list, we would definitely include that.
yeah, it's a fine line because I don't want to walk toward endorsement or anything
Okay.
like that. But if you would do me a favor, if you want to send me the email you had questioning what we may have available for posting, Bart, so I keep that within that channel.
Okay, I'll send you an email on it,
Something
Sean.
that's I can circulate on my side and then get some input from.
Okay.
Bart, and something else that's not on here is to put it on your website.
Absolutely.
And I think one of the advantage of doing that is for like sort of what you were just describing, Sean, where you want to make sure you don't fall into a position of maybe vouching for someone or endorsing someone. Then what you can say to them or any other under professional colleagues or board contacts or whatever, then it can be said, look on the Guarantee Association's website, there's information about the position. And so all you're then doing is saying, hey, it's out there. It's not, we are not distributing anything to anyone. We are just saying, this is where it is. If you're interested, go look at it.
And Jack, yeah, I like that because we have discussed. I want to make sure when I get the last category, your personal contacts, again, that we're not circumventing the process and anyone thinks it's a good old boy network. That if someone has an interest, we think someone should consider it, that we point them to a location to get the information just like anyone else.
Yes.
So,
And this is different from it like an RFP, where you're looking for an auditor or something like that, where you've got a list and you're going to send it to those people and maybe send it to other or make it available for other people to respond. Because there's no way that we would ever be able to get a distribution list that would make any sense.
And I don't know if the net would be too wide, and I don't know what's available through NAIC.
I
You
like
may.
the NAIC suggestion, Jared. I don't know if they do it, but it would at least be more specific to insurance regulatory lawyers.
We can look to see what the NAIC has. That would be hard to figure out. I've got it on the list here to check it.
Bart, along the same vein, and this is a pure ask, not a request. So I want
Okay.
your opinion on this. But what about both at the national level and the state level, the PNC Guarantee Association? I
We
realize we're
could.
different animals, but the pool of regulatory attorneys dealing in this
Right.
space.
Yeah, I know because working with the NCIGF, of course, I work with the Locke Lord firm a lot. And they have a lot of regulatory involvement, but they also are very, very experienced in property and casualty guarantee association and receiverships. So the NCIGF and possibly TP SIGA could be an option here, but I have them both on the list as well.
I totally defer to you. Just trying to cast the net broad. Jackie, question for you.
Yes.
How did we find you? How did you hear about this job?
Yeah, so it was actually the former general counsel of the association. And he was working at the Attorney General's office, and I was working at the Attorney General's office, and I wanted a different job at the Attorney General's office. And he saw my resume, and he called the Guarantee Association and said, "You need to hire this woman."
So category three, personal contacts.
Yes.
I
Want to say, Jackie, that was what, 93 or 94?
Was 94.
94.
Actually,
Yes.
March of 94 was when I started, so I don't remember the date, but 30 years.
Wow. And they've all been fun. Okay, any other thoughts on avenues for distribution?
I think once you have it listed, Bart, on the website, I can share a link with our general counsel to share with our external firms we use. I mean, we can, there's a lot of word of mouth. I mean, and I can
Yep.
send it to, I mean, I'll send it to Mitchell Williams. I can send it to a bunch of different, and they'll
Yep.
see it.
Yep.
I actually almost think we do that first. And if you end up getting 20 qualified applicants, don't bother spending the $500 on the state bar. Because I just looked up, it's not free. It's like minimum $599, $499. But I don't know. I just think if we get a good posting up, when Ted knows a million people, we just, and then, within a month and have a deadline potentially that we would like, we're going to consider applicants that we've received and we'd like to get it no later than May 1st or something. I don't know. I don't know because of the timeline you're on.
I agree with you, Patty. I think once this gets out there in the sort of, your contacts, the board's contacts, just what you were saying, you forward it to people, say, this is what's going on, this is where the information is, and with a deadline, I think you're going to get good responses.
Okay.
And my view on the matter is I think we're checking two boxes. 90% of the box is finding the right person, and that's not going to be had through a blanket, email sent to the Texas Bar Journal. But and so you're right. I think we're going to find the qualified candidates through word of mouth and relationships. But I do hear what Bart's saying, and that we need to be able to show that this process has been totally transparent. It's not a good old boy network, that we cast our net broad, and that any possible interested party had opportunity to learn of the opportunity. And so I'm fine with not going there initially, but I do like the idea of being able to show that we cast a broad net and there was plenty of publication of this opening.
Okay.
Yeah.
So I think we've kind of covered this. I'm pushing just a little bit, Ted, to go to this next item because it's important. If I may, item four.
Please, sir.
The most crucial thing we're going to draft here, and a lot of it, and the description of the duties of the position, that's going to be a big part of the application here. But what are the required elements? What are we the minimum requirements of the position? What does the application look like? What should they provide? Because what we found in RFPs, if they're consistently formatted, they're more comparable. If you let them come in any format, it can be confusing and they're hard to do an apples to apples comparison. So I think we need to come up with a consistent format. Here's what we're asking you to submit. Just go down the list. And then we need to decide the methodology. To whom is that submitted? Does someone on the committee want to gather that? Do you want me to gather that? Will this be through the mail? Would it be electronically? Will it be both? And then how much time do we allow from publicizing the position that it's open to allow applications to come in? So I want to open up that big, broad process for some thoughts.
It may be unfair of me to say, but my opinion is, as an initial vetting of applicants, that the appropriate place for those to be received would be you and or Jackie as a first line of vetting. Your expertise is critical to this. Bart, you from a perspective of what you would want as an executive director in terms of a new general counsel. And Jackie, in terms of filling your role, I think it's, I would look to you as I do today in my corporate structure, in my HR department, to do the first line of vetting. And then this committee then take those that make it through the first wave of vetting and hone in on individual characteristics based on the job description that Jackie's prepared. I realize that then is moving a lot of the responsibility and time to you all. So if that's not fair and that's something the committee should be doing, I'm happy to consider that. But for the reason I just mentioned, my preference would be for you guys to take the initial receipt of applicants and first vetting.
Okay, to make this somewhat efficient, I want to throw out, I think Jackie and I can draft the format of the application and our view of the required elements, and then also put in the duties, edited and organized, as we've discussed here today. And we can actually even submit a time frame. The question would be is, once we do that, would you like to have that distributed for review and comment individually back to me and Jackie via email? Or do you want us to draft that and we have a meeting to review and discuss?
My view is the former, unless you receive individual comment that might substantiate further discussion, just to expedite the process.
Jim and Patty, are you comfortable with that?
I'm totally comfortable.
Yeah, the same. Me too.
And Jackie, I volunteered you and I didn't even ask you. You comfortable with that?
Yeah, that's fine.
Thank you. So we will begin that process and get something out to the committee individually. Of course, remember, provide your comments back to me. You can't communicate as a committee. That's going to be a violation of Open Meetings Act. So send me your individual comments. I will work with Jackie to organize them, and maybe it'll take a couple of versions back to you. Here's the second draft. Here's the third draft to get to a final form.
That sounds good. And when you send that information, Bart, if you would include the pertinent sections of your overall timeline that you presented earlier in this call, just so we know, you know, I want to make sure that we allow for some cushion between, you know, if we're looking at a hard hire date of September, no later than October, and we backdate that to the negotiation process, I don't want to be squeezed between those dates. So it would be helpful to see the overall timeline together with the time allotted for receiving applications.
Yeah, I have a few thoughts on that, but it'd be a little bit of brainstorming right now. Let me get with Jackie and refine that. But there's my goal is to get a lot done with this committee between now and the July board meeting. And so we have all of April, May, and June to get the work done, get it on the street, get applications in the door. So we could do as much of that as we can by the end of June. And then we need to talk about the interview process. The interviews, I'm assuming, and Jackie, this is where it gets very tricky. If it's an open meeting, they're all conducted in executive session.
Right.
None of this is public.
Right.
So it would be an open meeting to conduct interviews, and then we would go into executive session and do interviews.
Right.
So that can be of the committee. It would appear to be too cumbersome to be of the full board, but I think that's for the committee to report to the board at our April 22nd meeting to see if the board has any strong views on whether the full board should be involved in interviews or just an evaluation of recommendations from the committee. I think the latter.
Yeah. I agree
I
with
agree.
That. And in a perfect world, you all will do the initial vetting. And if we have 5 or 10, what you all deem as highly qualified candidates, then we go through a second tier interview process. Ideally, you know, I'm in Austin. I can come there and be in person, but we do it as a video conference for those that can't. And we stack the interviews one after another.
Mm-hmm.
And then have a post-interview discussion within the committee and make our recommendations to the board.
Okay, I think that's a good plan. That handles the interviews and the board involvement here. So we should have a lot accomplished. And when we meet toward the end of July with the board, we could be 95% down the road here.
Bart, not to put you on the spot any more than I can.
Sure.
Do you have a target date of when you think you would like to get an RFP out by?
It's kind of tricky, but I would like to get something published around the 1st of May.
Okay. Thank you.
I think that's very doable. We do have a lot going on in April, but Jackie's used to my work. I think May 1st makes a lot of sense. And
so, Bart, if it's posted May 1st, you're thinking interviews then in June?
Yeah, May 1st, I was thinking you leave a month
mm-hmm.
for applicants to come in. We screen them, then we schedule interviews in June.
Okay.
And
that's
if you
helpful.
We have to carry over a few to early July. We still have time to get them all conducted before we get to the July board meeting, the end of July.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That sounds good.
And Chair Kennedy, I did build an executive session into this agenda. I'm not aware of any, I don't have anything specifically that I want to put out there today that would require an executive session. It's up to the committee. And then also, I'd always ask counsel if she has something that she feels she should share with the committee in executive session.
I don't have anything, Bart.
Neither do I. Other committee members, any reason to go into executive session for this initial call?
No.
I don't have anything.
Okay.
I think we can skip it.
And the next item, because there's no executive session, so there's no action after executive session. And the next one is, when would you like to meet again? I think I would recommend that Jackie and I work on our project here to get this out the door, work on a timeline, and we can get it done. And then I send you some dates in June. When I just want to see when you may or may not be out of the office vacationing, anything in June. I want to grab possible dates in June or interviews.
Yeah, sounds good.
So I will be back in touch on that. We cannot nail down the date today, but I will do some polling of the committee.
June's a good month for me. My son will be in summer school there, so I'll be attending. So May is a bad month for me. June, July, mainly June are good months.
Okay.
June is a good month for me as well. May's busy with travel, and July is as well.
Okay, Patty, June, any bad
I
travel?
was just actually gonna type in an email to you guys because I'm gonna be in Ireland, but I get back June 2nd. Then I'm in DC the first week of June, but the middle 2 weeks of June, I'm here and wide open. So I'll follow up with an email. There's
Okay.
2 days at the very end of June, I'm in Dallas for board meetings, but June. I actually have 2 weeks in a row that I'm not flying anywhere in the middle of June.
Okay, that sounds like a
So,
target. That sounds like a very good target. And with that, Chair Kennedy, I don't have anything else for the committee to consider today.
Any other matters anyone wants to bring forward? If not, should I adjourn the meeting?
Feel free.
Hearing none. Okay. The time is 12:17 p.m. on March 25th, 2024, in this meeting of the General Counsel Search Committee of the Board of Directors of the Texas Life and Health Insurance Guarantee Association has been held pursuant to the Texas Open Meeting Act is adjourned.